Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Incoming transmission.
Politics. Not good at politics. Surely there are others who are better suited.
Trek Politics with Mary L. Trump and Bob Seska.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of Trek Politics. I'm Mary Trump with my co-host, Bob Seska.
Hello.
And today we are extraordinarily fortunate to have as our guest the amazing Jerry Ryan. That's 7 of 9 from Voyager and most recently from Picard. So, Bob, I am really looking forward to this conversation because, well, one, because it's Jerry Ryan.
Yeah, yeah.
There's that. And two, because of the pivotal role she's played and mm-hmm. because of the way women and their characters have evolved over the course of Star Trek since the late 1960s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so when I think of Seven of Nine's character arc, I put it in the same category as Picard's arc and Data's arc. Very rich character arcs where a lot of things happen along the way. And it really speaks to Jerry's versatility as an actor to be able to hit all those beats along that journey as a character. And so we're going to talk with her about all of that.
And it's you and I had this conversation a couple of weeks ago about how when a show is so established and the characters are placed into a world that already exists, you know, we understand how the world functions, and it's even in new iterations, we know what the rules of the game are, that we kind of take it for granted that these actors are their characters. Mm-hmm. And it's not frequently that we actually get reminded, and I'm thinking of an episode we've mentioned before, Reunion, in which we got to see that the reason Terry Farrell is so convincing as Jadzia Dax is because she's an amazing actor. Yeah. And in Reunion, we got to see a depth that, you know, you don't get to see in a procedural series all the time. And that's why I think Seven of Nine, Data in his many incarnations, and Captain Picard, as you mentioned, with the arc he had, we get to see it more frequently with these characters because the actors get to push the envelope more than they otherwise might.
So we're recording this episode just a couple of days after season 2, episode 1, A Strange New Worlds premiered on Paramount Plus. And so we'd love to talk about that, get into, because I had a lot of positive things to say and one very specific negative thing to say about this particular episode. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, Mary, in terms of how you felt about season 2, episode 1, and whether the trend, the overwhelmingly positive trend of the first season, has now perpetuated into season 2.
Yeah. I, first of all, I'm so happy to have the show back. It has enormous potential. I love the cast. So I was happy to see at the very beginning that Kirk and number one, Kirk. Sorry. Definitely not Kirk.
Yeah.
Wow. Captain Pike and everyone are in touch, and that he's helping her out. And that is going, I assume that's going to be a through line because we're not entirely sure if the timeline he believes he's on is actually going to play out or if clearly there are questions. I was a little disappointed that 5 minutes into the show, both of them disappear.
Oh, yes. Well, and that's the thing with Pike, and specifically Anson Mount's portrayal of Captain Pike. You miss him when he's not there. And one of the things I responded to most about Pike is that there's a soft underbelly to that character where he's a strong leader while at the same time bringing this level of radical empathy as well.
Yeah, and a willingness to be self-deprecating and make fun of himself, which is, I think, a really good way to put at ease people who are, you know, certainly lower ranks, like ensigns, for example. So he's just so charming and, but in a very, they're all charming, but he's charming in a very different way. That I think makes him relatable and really, it definitely wants you, makes you want to spend time with the character, which we didn't get to do so much because once again, at the very beginning of an episode in a season, we have a character committing massive insubordination.
You seem really fascinated with the insubordination of Star Trek, Starfleet crew members.
Yes, I am fascinated because it is a staple of the show.
Yes.
You know, practically every episode in the original series, somebody is committing insubordination and somebody's being really racist towards Spock. So, so it's this trend, not the racism, hopefully, but the certainly insubordination. And I think, and we, you know, we're going to talk about this with Jerry and how Todd Stashwick's character gets one thing really right. And it's that, you know, insubordination isn't cool. And I've wondered is it, if it's because that, you know, Starfleet is not a military organization. You know, the mission of these crews is not to go fight wars, it's to explore. So I assume that it's because they have a completely different agenda. They have a they see their mandate differently. And if, you know, borrowing a starship that's in space dock anyway, and it's not doing anything, if borrowing a starship kind of illegally is going to help them save a life, so be it. Do you think that's what's going on here? Because I do find it fascinating.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I think the other part of it is construction from a narrative point of view. It's a creative choice. So you've got rules, and if you break those rules, that equals drama. It's like the problem that season one and season two of The Next Generation ran into was Gene Roddenberry's sort of strident notion that there be no interpersonal conflicts. Well, that's fine when we're talking about an idealistic future utopia, but it's a little bit more problematic when it comes to storytelling because drama comes from human interactions and human conflict. It's the objective and obstacle nature of storytelling that I think lends itself to insubordination, that sort of thing. And so, and by the way, I should mention here before we talk about any details about episode one, there will be spoilers. There will be spoilers throughout this conversation. And so in that sense, so what happens in this episode, just generally, I'm just going to set it up here to give us a starting point. Pike takes a shuttle to help Una and then disappears from the episode. Then La'an contacts the Enterprise with this emergency message. Klingons are doing something and she's in danger. So can you come and help? And that's when Spock steals the Enterprise with the endorsement of the new chief engineer played by the great Carol Kane. So
what a great addition. Oh,
it
my goodness.
It really is. It's inspired. Yes.
So, so awesome.
I love the fact, I love this new species that they're introducing to Star Trek, which is a species that's been around for hundreds of years interacting with humans on Earth. And and the funny thing about this species is not only do they live for thousands of years, but they're also funny and weird, which funny, I love.
Funny, weird, quirky, idiosyncratic. And I think she had one of the best lines. I'm not going to say, you know, in case people haven't watched, there will be spoilers, but figure it out. See if you can find the line I'm talking about. Towards the end of the episode, she's speaking with Spock. And she'd known his mom, which I thought was a nice touch. And she just is talking about how difficult, the hardest thing about being a member for species. And I just thought it was perfection. You guys have to watch it. Her well, it's Carol Kane, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Performance is amazing. Anyway, so the Enterprise goes off to see what's up with the odds.
Yes. And it turns out that the Klingons are, or a faction of Klingons, I should say, are staging a false flag. And when I saw that, I was like, what a great time to be doing a Trek politics podcast. We can talk about the false flags. And when we say that, we're not saying it in the Alex Jones conspiracy theory sense of the term, where, you know, and this is, you know, you run into issues with conspiracy theorists when sometimes the conspiracy turns out to be real. And in the case of some false flags that have been proposed throughout American history, it's a real thing. And the one thing that I always thought of, or the one thing that I thought of immediately when it came to this episode, was this thing that was planned by the Joint Chiefs in the early 60s. I think this was after the Bay of Pigs. It was a thing called, it was a false flag operation called Operation Northwoods. This is a real thing. And it, I feel like I should be doing my Alex Jones voice when I'm talking about this, but it actually
Because
existed.
We want people to believe you.
So, right. I still need to maintain some credibility here. But it was, Northwoods was an actual thing where they were going to stage an attack on an American warship or an attack on a commuter jet and blame the Cubans and make that a pretext for invading Castro's Cuba. And so this was put into the mix in the Kennedy White House. And thank goodness JFK vetoed the idea. But this came from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is an incredible thing when you think about our modern politics and the way modern White Houses operate. This was pre-Watergate when there were guys who worked, and I say guys specifically, very few women in those days, guys sitting around the White House just getting drunk on their power. I think Gordon Liddy talks about how the White House plumbers would just get drunk on their power, their ability to basically operate with impunity. So clearly, when it came to coming up with some of these false flag operations, Operation Gemstone, which was Liddy's proposal to the committee to reelect, had some elements of false flags in there, too. There was another one, I don't know if you're aware of this one, Mary, called Operation Dirty Trick, which included a thing where if John Glenn's Mercury mission failed, the government was going to blame Cuba and use that as a pretext to invade Cuba. And so, so many different things. So with the Klingons, it makes perfect sense that they would try to stage this false flag using this Federation vessel that they were developing. And then they were going to attack this D-7 Klingon attack cruiser and then use that as a pretext for going back to war with the Federation. To make a long story short, that's kind of the central idea, the central plot line of the episode.
So we see, or we can assume that that's going to continue to be a theme throughout the season, which I think is very cool. So curious, you said there was one specific negative.
Yes. And it's not a capital case. I want to be clear about this. I love the episode, but the only thing I didn't like was Dr. Mbenga and Nurse Chapel punching their way through the Klingons after injecting themselves with what seemed to be the super soldier serum from Captain America. There was something that they inject, and maybe I missed this. Maybe this was set up on something else and I've forgotten, but there was some sort of adrenaline thing or something that they injected into themselves that gave them super strength and super agility and so on. So, and then they go through this extended sort of hallway fight scene that seemed like something out of Daredevil or something like that. And while it was well choreographed and well shot, and of course, I love Dr. Mbenga and Nurse Chapel as characters, one of the best things about season one of Strange New Worlds was in the episode Serene Squall, where they employ the Alpha Braga 4 gambit to trigger a mutiny on the Serene Squall among the crew members.
Yep.
So this was a matter of Pike using words and expertise to trick the crew of the Serene Squall into staging a mutiny. And so to me, that's Star Trek. That's the Star Trek way of getting out of a jam, using your head instead of your fists. So, and I'm not totally a pacifist or anything like that, but in universe, it would have made more sense if Mbenga and Chapel had come up with some sort of way to fool the Klingons into letting them go, or some way to get out of that room they were trapped in that involved some kind of strategy, rather than, well, here, put this hypo spray in and then we're going to have super strength and punch our way out of this. So you know what I mean? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one, it did feel like cheating. And two, I mean, just because something gives you super strength, what you're impervious, totally impervious to being injured. I mean, I don't know. I like, unless you grow armor or something, it didn't really fly. And I don't really need to see those two characters fighting. You know?
Yeah. And also, if you wait a few minutes, they really show their mettle as Starfleet officers or as members of Starfleet. I don't think Chapel is a full-fledged member of Starfleet, but regardless, what they do after they do all the punching is they eject themselves into space, which is an immensely brave thing to do. Mm-hmm. And even Mbenga says, oh, you know what? This is going to hurt. This is going to suck. Get ready. And so, to me, if you really want to underscore their bravery and their dedication to their mission, that would be it. You don't need to have the punching to do that, which I think undermined one of the core things about Star Trek, which is, you know, using your head instead of your fists. And so that was my one thing.
Yeah. And honestly, I think that led to what was one of the best, not scenes exactly, but reactions we've seen. And it to your earlier point, reminds us why, as much as Gene Roddenberry got right, he was completely wrong about not having interpersonal conflict, because interpersonal conflict can also just mean internal conflict that creates interpersonal complexity. And Spock's reaction to Nurse Chapel lying unconscious in sickbay was just extraordinary, I thought. And I think it bodes well for what is going to happen with that character's evolution and that relationship. And especially given the fact that I really liked Pring. Like her.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find that couple like really convincing and charming, but there's clearly something else going on.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be fascinating.
Oh, yeah. Spock amok. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention Spock amok. This is one of the best episodes of season one. I just so enjoyed that. I mean, I typically like my Star Trek a little bit more serious and a little less jokey, but it was so funny and entertaining, and they played it just the right right tone. They didn't go too far with it. It was just funny enough. And to have it contained with two Vulcans who are very reserved in the first place, and having Spock speaking like T'Pring was just so entertaining to watch. In fact, that's one of the episodes that if I know, and I do know, I live with one, someone who doesn't love Star Trek, if they were to say, if Kimberly were to say, hey, let's watch a Star Trek episode tonight, which will never happen.
How do you stay together?
That would be one that I would put in. It's like the Strange New Worlds equivalent of Star Trek IV. It's kind of accessible to more than just us nerds. You know what I mean?
Or I think Trouble with Tribbles is that kind of?
Oh, yeah, that one too. That's another great one. Yeah, yeah. And there are a bunch of episodes from Next Generation. We can take our pick of dozens.
Maybe we
of
should
things.
Do that—a rundown of Star Trek for non-Star Trek people.
So, yeah, that's a great idea.
As a gateway drug.
I would love to do that. The gateway drug episode. That's perfect.
Like, we could even have people on who, like Kimberly, are not into Star Trek. Have them as their assignment: go watch one of these episodes and then come back and report.
Yes, but honey, it's for the show.
That's right.
Say that. So Akiva and Henry Alonso Myers, who's running Strange New Worlds, got it right with their retcon of Uhura knowing the Klingon language, which was such a relief to see. In Star Trek VI, they had Uhura comedically fumbling around the Klingon language, not understanding it, trying to desperately look up the words in a paper-printed English to Klingon dictionary, I guess. And even though she's this expert communicator who's been on the Enterprise for how many decades at that point, And while it was a funny scene, obviously we all love seeing that, and we is condemning food. I never forget that one translation of the thing that she got wrong, which is we is condemning food, she says to the Klingon. And so, but it kind of insulted her. And I know that Nichelle Nichols was not thrilled with that particular scene from Star Trek VI. So in this sense, what they did with Strange New Worlds was retconning in a very positive way that I really embraced in this episode.
Yeah, and they, you know, we learned, I think for the first time in Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams reboot,
yeah,
that Lieutenant Uhura was fluent in not just many, many languages, but many dialects of specific languages. And it's good to see her getting her due here, because clearly she's brilliant. And, you know, to see, especially when it's, you know, Uhura's embodied by Nichelle Nichols kind of being made a fool of, that wasn't pleasant.
No. Definitely not. And you know, I do want to do a separate episode where we talk about some of the rank racism against Klingons and in particular Vulcans throughout Star Trek canon, especially some of the early seasons and movies.
Yeah. And we saw some of that in this episode.
Yeah.
And I wish they would stop it, quite honestly.
Really?
It just doesn't work.
Yeah.
And looking back at the original, I've said this to you before, and we started with the insubordination, but the racism again against Vulcans by inferior off. I mean, not that it's acceptable anyway, but you know, when you are Lieutenant Commander and you've got an ensign being racist against you, openly, it's just like that, and the level of disrespect is in racism is just tolerated. It just doesn't set well. I mean, it's bad enough when it's McCoy.
Well, you made a good observation about McCoy, though, that he's more like Archie Bunker than someone far worse than Nick Fuentes, for example.
Yes, you know? I mean, it's still offensive, but it's like most of the time with McCoy, he's joking around, and even though it's not funny. It's not, there's nothing malicious behind it, but you know, you can always tell, just as we can tell in our world, that when somebody's angry and they default to the difference of the other, then clearly there's some unresolved issues there.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a bout of road rage and the thing you say to the person who got you angry was to point out their race or whatever, so for, I don't know, I just, I know it was a throwback to, again, that first Star Trek movie helmed by J.J. Abrams. Don't you feel anything? You just soulless, pointy ear. I know it was one of those hat tips.
Yeah, yeah.
But it just doesn't work for me anymore. Please stop.
So the dedication at the end to Nichelle Nichols, I thought was perfectly appropriate, getting back to the Klingons and what they were able to accomplish with Uhura in that episode. That was heart-wrenching to see that come up.
It made me cry. I wasn't expecting it. And it just reminded me what we lost and what a titan she was and is and her legacy and... You know, again, I had this massive amount of respect and affection for her growing up. And I just thought that she was just total badass. That was lovely to see.
Well, okay. At this point, we'll bring in Jeri Ryan. Because we have a ton of questions for her. So we want to give her plenty of time. And this is so exciting. I can't believe episode 2, we're already talking to 7 of 9.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax. the way car buying should be.
So you've got to tell us. I'm looking for the inside scoop here because I haven't talked with Terry about this specifically, but I got to hear it from your perspective. Dungeons and Dragons at Todd Stashwick's house. What's the inside scoop on D&D at Stashwick's?
I got to be honest. That was intense. That was intense. That was like massive nerddom.
yeah.
But in addition to, I mean, and it's amazing. Todd goes all in. He is astonishing in his nerd lair and the table, the whole thing. But that's a level of commitment that I just don't.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's work. And it was stressful for me because I'm playing with a bunch of damn writers.
Yeah.
And they're all into it. And I was like, okay, so tell me this exciting thing about your character. I was like, guys, no, I'm not here to work. I'm not going to entertain a bunch of writers who do this. This is not an improv game for me. I don't enjoy that. That's not fun.
Yeah, they should be writing your character for you, damn it.
Yes. I was like, no, I just want to play a game. I don't want to have to be creative and think of shit to entertain people. I can't do that. I couldn't do it.
Well, it came across. You became a meme.
Yeah.
Yes.
I can't tell you the number of times I've sat across that expression. I'm talking about Star Trek or Star Wars or one of these comic book movies, and I'm getting that look, exactly your expression in that photograph, right back at me. I mean, you jumped right into the deep end of the nerd pool.
You did.
Apart from being on Star Trek.
Like being shoved into the deep end. Yeah. And then he whips out a voice-changing microphone at one point.
Oh, my God, yes. I saw.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Well, just for the record, I just try to keep up with the awesome memes. I put you in a beach chair next to Chris Christie, but I'm just not good enough at Photoshop, so I didn't post it.
That's kind of fantastic.
Yeah, and I did a Photoshop, too. I put you behind Dr. Fauci doing the facepalm as Donald
that
was talking about drinking bleach or whatever the hell that was, whichever one of those thousands of press conferences he did during COVID. That's the perfect expression for that, I think.
Yeah.
Or actually for the last 7 years, but anyway.
Right. So when did you learn that 7 was going to become the... spoilers, first of all. I got to say, spoilers. There's going to be spoilers throughout this. When did you first learn that 7 was going to become the captain of the Enterprise? Did you know early in the shoot, or did Terry withhold that information until the final episode?
He told me that before we started shooting. We had our like Zoom meetings with the producers or whatever, and he told me that that was his sort of end game.
Wow. So what was your reaction? Was it, okay, all right, this is, oh my God, what's going on?
Yeah, kind of that. I mean, I was shocked. It's not what I had ever anticipated. I was very shocked. But I mean, how cool, you know, and what a cool journey for this character and what a cool arc from beginning as, you know, a Borg. machine to becoming captain of the Enterprise was pretty cool.
I'm glad you brought up 7's arc because it's one of the most dramatic arcs in the entire Star Trek canon.
Oh, yeah.
Because you did. You started out in one place as the lead enemy of the Federation. And then it ends up, you're the captain of the Enterprise through all of these different iterations. So basically, much like real life, you go through all these different phases and lives within the life of that character. Which stage of that arc was the most fun to play for you? Like, which iteration of 7 was kind of your zone?
I mean, Fenris Ranger 7 was pretty cool. I think that was because it was such a departure from where you'd last seen her.
Mm-hmm.
I think everything since has been really fun. So much more freeing than it was on Voyager, obviously. In a lot of ways. No, it's all been cool. I'm sorry, I'm petting my dog. He's also here. This is like the biggest love fest I've ever seen because they actually hate each other and chase each other around the house. But
they're friends of the podcast. That's what it is.
Yeah. Exactly. They want to be on the pod.
Well, I mean, 7 also, just in the context of Voyager, had so many different iterations. There was an episode called Infinite Regress. where you play a little girl, you play a Klingon, you play a Vulcan.
Previous assimilated personalities.
Yeah. And it really, it underscores your range as an actor to be able to deal with all of those different iterations of this same character. Is there something about the character that lent itself to this kind of an evolution or this kind of variety of portrayals?
Well, I mean, just the basis of this character, you're going to have the biggest growth of any character because you don't even start out human. So, you know, she was raised as a Borg. She was assimilated as a child. She knew nothing about being a human, nothing about being an individual. So already from the outset, you have to have a huge growth, like much more than a normal character who's human. So it was, I was really lucky. And I've said that from day one. This was a gift as an actor, this character.
Yeah, and in some ways, I think Seven sort of tracks the evolution of Star Trek as well. I mean, it's amazing to look back at some of the original series, sometimes even Voyager and, The Next Generation, and then Voyager and Deep Space Nine, which I think ran concurrently or overlapped.
Yeah, and Voyager just, and DS9 were on together, I think.
Right. Yeah. And to see how the show itself has changed. And again, part of what we try to get at here is that the show has always challenged assumptions about social justice, people's place in society. And sometimes it has not succeeded, but it's always been willing to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think when you see where these characters ended up, particularly in Picard season three, it's been something of a revelation. And to have characters that have been on the show for so long with a huge gap in between, you know, you were doing other stuff for a while there. to come back and just nail it the way you nailed it was pretty extraordinary as somebody who's been watching Star Trek since, I don't know, 1971, probably.
Thank you.
Right?
So I did want to I wanted to ask you one question, and it probably sounds sexist, but it's not, because it's about how the show portrayed characters through costume. The pilot of the original Star Trek included a first officer who was a woman, played by Majel Barrett, and who wore the same uniform as the men. That did not succeed into, she did not make it into the show, as we know, as the first officer, and women, as we know.
She wasn't in the mini dress?
No, she didn't. She did not remain the same character. She became Nurse Chapel. And yes, and the women were wearing the mini dress. And when Next Generation rolled around, Deanna Troi was wearing a cat suit. And in the episode, Rob's going to have to. I'm terrible with names of episodes. He knows all of them. Chain of Command, I think it was called, but it was a two-part.
Yeah, it was Captain Jellicoe. Yeah,
Captain Jellicoe and Captain Picard gets kidnapped and all that stuff. And Jellicoe insists that Deanna Troi, because she's a Starfleet officer, in addition to being counselor, wear a Starfleet uniform. And it was absolutely, I think I fell out of my chair because it made such a difference to the character's authority and professionalism. And I've seen it similarly with more recent iterations, like the costumes in Picard for the women. Like, you guys just are allowed, but you are actually allowed to dress like the kick-ass, strong women you are without being burdened by high heels and cat suits. Did that help with this latest iteration? Because I know as a viewer, it made a huge difference.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, Star Trek has always been, it's of its time, you know? So the original series, the women were in micro mini skirts because it was the 60s and that's what they wore. And that was what they wanted to see. And it was network television. And in, you know, the 90s for Voyager and, you know, that was network television in the 1990s. And that was, you know, they wanted to get attention and they wanted a sexy character. And they, and I've been asked about that a lot with that costume and why I was okay with that. The only reason that I was okay with that is because of the way the character was written.
Yeah.
Because it was completely antithetical to Seven, so the mm-hmm. entire way the character presented herself and was written. And so it was that contrast that made it okay for me. But I don't think you'd be seeing a corset and catsuit and 4-inch heels now. I don't think that would be happening. Yeah. Yeah. And it didn't make sense because that's not of our time. Do you know what I mean? It's just, mm-hmm. that was what pop culture at the time accepted and wanted and demanded in network television. And that's what it was. And it's very different now. Thank God for all of us. It's yeah. really very different. And
but it's such a good point because one of the reasons I think Star Trek has been able to, in some ways that are obvious, but in some ways they're sort of surreptitious, challenge the social order is mm-hmm. because it's followed the trappings of what's acceptable at the time. In terms of dress and things like that. Bob, we were talking about this recently, that there have been these through lines though that still continue to this day. I was rewatching some of the older episodes, and then it comes up again in the first episode of Strange New Worlds. Like the insubordination. Goes away. Yep. It's the most fascinating thing. And I think that's one of the reasons that Picard season 3 was so fascinating and why Todd Stashwick's character was...
There's more.
Oh!
There we go. Okay.
Was so complicated and fascinating, especially in the way your character interacted with his.
And how amazing was he, by the way?
Yes.
Ah,
amazing.
So good.
And you both had such amazing chemistry, and it's something that is actually, and I know I'm, it sounds like I'm brown nosing, but it's true, where you had automatic chemistry with a lot of other Star Trek actors.
Yeah. But they're incredible actors, first of all.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
just great people. And I, you know, they have phenomenal, fun personalities, and we have similar working styles, and it was so easy. It was just so easy. Mm-hmm. And I was so lucky to get to play with these guys and to bounce off each other. And it was easy.
Along those lines, in terms of defining, like, okay, where does Seven sit in this ensemble when you compare it to the other Star Trek shows? And I always saw Seven as analogous to, I don't know if I'm the first person who said this, but, and this is just how weird I am. I always saw Seven as analogous to Worf, and Seven was a member of a formerly enemy species learning to adjust to Starfleet norms. And the other thing with Seven is I remember wondering when she might snap and try to assimilate everyone. There was a level of danger about that mm-hmm. character, a former Borg there amongst these Starfleet characters. Was there another shoe that was going to drop with Seven? Was that ever kind of a thing that was discussed behind the scenes? Like the danger of having Seven as part of this crew, lending to excitement or drama. Yeah.
You know, that wasn't, these aren't because she's a Borg, you know, that's,
yeah.
there's always that tension. So that was never specifically, you know, spelled out, I don't think, at least not for mm-hmm. me, but that was always just the understood tension. That's, I think, why it was so fascinating to have a Borg specifically.
Yeah.
And also because that's the one species, I mean, there are a lot of dangerous species or whatever, but that's the one that is, I think, the most antithetical to humanity, to
yeah.
ours. Mm-hmm. Like, we're so into our individuality, and that's so important, and that's such who we are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So much who we are. And the fact that it was from a hive mind, and there is no individuality. And so she has to learn all of that. And that was what was so interesting and fun for me in the way that they wrote Seven, especially in the early years on Voyager, is that they didn't shy away from that gray area
yeah.
of her pointing out humanity's foibles and mm-hmm. and the Federation's and what wasn't so great about us. Do you know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah.
They didn't make Janeway riding in on a white horse and she's perfect, perfect, perfect. It was like, oh no, this is messed up. You're doing the exact same thing to me that the Borg did. you're not giving me a choice. You're forcing me to separate and become something I don't want to be. And I love that they did that and that they didn't shy away from that.
Yeah, and I was just rewatching that Scorpion two-parter where Seven is first introduced and Species 8472. And I marvel at those two episodes for a number of reasons. But one of them is that the bravery of Catherine Janeway to beam aboard a Borg cube and try to negotiate some sort of alliance with the Borg based on some sort of janky new technology that the Doctor has developed with these nanoviruses or whatever they were. And I was just astonished with that because we're talking about the mortal enemy of Starfleet, mortal enemy of the Federation, mortal enemy to anyone who's not a Borg. And suddenly Janeway's beaming aboard this cube and negotiating an alliance with the Borg. And through that process, Seven gets introduced. But if you could slingshot around the sun and travel back to shooting those first two Voyager episodes, what would you?
Let me just answer that one for you very quickly. Would not.
So you're just rejecting the premise of the question. Like, I am just not even going to. Well,
but
I mean,
anyway,
what would
continue.
You, if you could, though, what would you tell yourself? If you go back in time on your time traveling DeLorean, you borrow Terry Metalis's time traveling DeLorean, you go back to that first episode that you were in, what would you tell yourself as a performer on that show?
Oh, God. Hang in. It gets better.
Yeah, there you go.
That was rough. It was just rough. And, you know, I was in the full Borg suit with the prosthetics and the laser over one eye and... So if you have one eye covered, I don't know if you've ever had an eye patch or anything.
Yeah,
like that. You have
it's
no
awful.
Depth perception.
Yeah, it's awful.
And stages are, you know, levels and steps, and I'm falling all over the place. And I had prosthetics that were a full bald cap that went down my whole neck and wrapped around my neck, which makes it, you know, it's like a, you know, a quarter inch thick of latex all the way around your neck. Mm-hmm. And then the Borg suit, which was really thick rubber and fiberglass and all of that built on top of the neoprene, like, you know, like diving suit material base. But that was fitted to me as a full, they made a full body cast. This was before we had scans and all the shit that they do now, which makes it so much easier.
Yeah.
I had to have a full body plaster cast made.
Oh my God.
And, that was a whole other thing.
Yeah.
But that's what this suit was built on. But you don't have another quarter inch thick layer of latex around your neck when that was made. And so once we got on set with the prosthetics, once this neck, and it was a high neck on the suit, once that was together, it pressed on my carotid artery when I turned my head.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God.
No one of us ever saw that. It just wasn't.
You know. And Bob, you're making her relive this.
No.
I'm getting claustrophobia. I have claustrophobia. And I'm freaking out. I'm having an anxiety attack just listening to it.
It was not super fun. Yeah. So no, I would not go back and relive those episodes.
Well, also, I mean, you can tell us what your experience was, but I would also imagine that just entering into an already established cast in a legendary by then series of, you know, after the original and the Next Generation, that in itself must have presented some extraordinarily challenging.
Yeah, it did. And I mean, the entering the legendary world was less of a intimidation thing for me. That was kind of one of the drawbacks of the job. That's why I'd sort of avoided it for the first couple of times the audition came around.
Mm. Interesting.
But joining the existing cast, it's hard. It's hard to be the new kid to begin with.
Yep.
They were writing out a character to make room for my character, which makes it even more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And there were, it was not a, for the most part, everybody was very welcoming and lovely and great, but there, it was tough. It was not a pleasant 4 years for me.
Did you draw upon your acting skills? I mean, what helped you get through that? Because I mean, it had to have been, it sounds like it was immensely nerve-wracking. There are several layers to that, including the fact that, well, I'm coming aboard this show and if I fuck it up, then bye-bye. And so there's that layer to it too. And I'm an interloper now on this series that's already had a following, that's already got fans. These are all considerations. So how do you cope with that? How do you manage to, did you use it as part of playing this role?
Yes. But honestly, again, it was less the, oh, I'm coming into this established thing and I could pick this up. It was less that because they were pretty clear about that. They were writing this character to kind of save the show because it wasn't doing extraordinarily well or whatever. It was struggling to find its feet in those first few seasons, apparently. Mm-hmm. I didn't watch it. I don't know. But that's what my understanding was from the beginning. That's what I was told. And that's why they wanted this drama with this character who was, you know, could butt heads with the captain and bring the tension and bring the danger and bring whatever. It was hard, but it was hard. It was less hard because of that than it was personalities on set and that sort of internal drama. It was just rough. It was rough. Yeah. You know, I was an army brat growing up, so I was always the new kid. We moved all the time. Right. It was always new. You always have to learn how to get along with people, get the lay of the land. And so that sort of lends itself to the nomadic life of an actor.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So, you know, fast forward what, 3 decades? sorry.
Two, for sure. Yeah.
That's like a very long time. What was this must have been just an entirely different experience because one, obviously it's there's so many known quantities. But when we spoke to Terry last week, I'm thinking that he was just having the time of his life. And he said that actually the 2 days they had to shoot on Enterprise D, he couldn't even process it because he was just like, oh my God, I'm in awe and I'm gonna fuck everything up and all of these legends are watching.
So much pressure. Yeah. So much pressure from all sides.
Yeah.
And so much stress and the time crunch and the budget crunch and all of it. And that was frustrating for me because I know him so well and I've known him for so long because I don't know if he told you that. We started out on Voyager the same year. He was a PA. He was a production assistant.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating.
The makeup trailer and we became buddies because we were the new kids. And I know what a genuine fan he is and how much he loves this franchise and loves these characters.
Yeah.
And wanted so badly to tell these stories and to do right by all of these characters. And by all rights, he should have been just relishing. If it was a fair world, he would have been relishing every second he was on set and be able to enjoy it. And he wasn't able to enjoy it. He was so stressed and just had it coming at him from all sides constantly. So that I wish was different for him. I wish he was able to enjoy the process more.
So and obviously being the person who was running the show, he did have to deal with a lot of things that nobody else had to deal with. Yeah. And thankfully he is able to enjoy the fruits of his labor because the success since it's over has been just phenomenal. Yeah. But as an actor sort of coming home, I guess, in a way, how was that? And did you feel any of the same pressures or did you feel like you could finally just have fun? Because that's the thing about this series. And again, who knows? Because I think the fantasy as a viewer who loves the show, who loves the characters, who admires the actors is that the relationships on screen exist off screen and everybody gets along and has fun together. It really seemed like that.
That is not always the case.
No.
It's very seldom the case. But in this instance, this cast, that particular cast, the next gen people especially, have been friends since they started. And I've known all of them except Patrick. Patrick was the only one that I'd only met once over the years before we started doing the part. Everyone else I've known and we've been friends because conventions or Star Trek events or whatever. We've just known each other. And it's so we've all been friends. And a couple of them I've worked with as directors over the years, Brakesy and LeVar. But to get to work with them in this context was so much fun. It was chaos. because there was a whole lot of laughter, but it was so much fun with these guys. It was just so much fun.
I think all three of us share many values with the Star Trek future. Do you ever find yourself leaving the set at the end of the day, Jerry, and kind of re-entering 20th or 21st century life and feeling a sense of dread or sadness? Yeah. Like, wow, oh my God, there's a cop beating up a guy in the street and half of LA is on fire. We have a long, long way to go. Damn it.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. More frequently than you can imagine, especially in the last
Pretty sure we can imagine.
I have a little more insight than most. Yeah, no, absolutely.
And I think that's, again, you had mentioned earlier the ways in which Star Trek has been willing to challenge the culture in which it exists, you know, with
from the outset. That was from, what it was set up to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the reasons we wanted to start this podcast is because not to talk about our politics through the lens of Star Trek, because that is politicizing Star Trek, to talk about the ways in which Star Trek has challenged us to be better people. And you can only do that if you're willing to admit what you're getting wrong. So that has been something, and we saw this in Picard, we're seeing this in Strange New Worlds, that continued willingness, I think, is why the show appeals to everybody, even though some people do seem surprised that Star Trek has always worn its heart on its sleeve, so to speak.
Well, yeah. I've heard in the last year, especially, or 2 years since woke became a derogatory term on the right. Yeah. Oh, and when Star Trek started being woke, I was like, I'm sorry, did you watch the show?
It was in 1968, I believe.
Yeah. Because, that was the entire point of this show, is to point out what society, where we as a society are failing, and how we can achieve a future that Star Trek is depicting, where people accept each other and accept other species and cultures and races and aren't terrified of them. You embrace and you learn to accept and applaud each other's differences.
Right.
And appreciate each other's differences and not be terrified of everyone who's different from you. And that's what Star Trek has done from day one of the original series. You hold a mirror up to society in a way that's probably a little less threatening because it's a different species or whatever.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But from the beginning, that's what it's done and what it's set out to do.
There's this, and this is kind of a loaded question, so forgive me in advance, but there's this obvious cult-like thing with the Borg, which makes Seven a kind of apostate to that cult, having withdrawn from that, whether it's someone escaping from Scientology or there's a particular political cult that I think we all are aware of. So her story arc is partly about deprogramming herself from that collective. And in the kindest possible terms, we all have a family member who seems to have been assimilated into one of these cults that I shall go nameless via the internet or social media. How do we, in your experience playing this character that escaped from this collective, how do we deprogram these people who we know, or are they lost? Is there some secret formula that you're aware of? Is it empathy or kindness or understanding, or is it some sort of more disruptive thing that shakes them out of their torpor on this? What is it?
Honestly, I wish I knew. I wish that playing this character had given me some insight and that I could do it, because it's personal experience in my own family.
Yeah.
And it's constant brainwashing by propaganda that is nonstop. And it's getting worse instead of better.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to deprogram or counteract that. It's scary. It's really, really frightening.
And I think part of the problem is that there's this ability to absorb hypocrisy and cognitive dissonance and never feel challenged. So the fact that there are people who love Star Trek and miss it, the message of it entirely.
They just love looking at the pretty spacious. I think that must be what it is. If you haven't watched this show, did you was it the sound off? Or,
like, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Some of it is as subtle as William Shatner's acting. I mean,
yes! And I love Bill, but
he's amazing. He's absolutely amazing.
This was very direct.
Yeah, if you listen to him recite the preamble to the Constitution, there's nothing subtle going on here. So it is a little bit challenging, shall we say.
I don't know how to counteract. I wish that I knew how to counteract that, because it's really scary.
Well, there's obviously this is not Star Trek, but there may be some sort of lesson with Ted Lasso. And the way I'm sort of connecting these two very different shows is that the Doctor does something for Seven in the episode The Gift, which I think your third episode on the show, where Seven gets her, you know, fake eyeball to replace the Borg implant. And that is something that that the Doctor does out of empathy, which is striking for some for a character that's a hologram. Okay. Yeah. And so in that sense, that starts Seven's journey to becoming more human in a sense. That helps Seven to deprogram from the Borg collective, that sort of generosity and kindness. And so I wonder if there's something to that, because that's what the Doctor does in that episode is something that Ted Lasso would do. And so in that sense, I don't know, but in my experience, it doesn't seem like that would even function as a solution. Listen, specifically empathy. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know for society as a whole, but
yeah,
I mean, I'm talking about family members, and I've known them my entire life, and this is not, they're not the way I was raised. It was not what I was brought up to believe. It is not, it's very unsettling to watch what's happening this close.
Yeah. I think that's harder than if you've always known people to be that way.
Yeah.
Yes, because it feels insidious, right?
Yeah, that's different. If this was the always the mindset, that's one thing. Mm. But when it's not, and it's such, the embrace of something that is so foreign to everything that they've ever been is really terrifying.
You know, we can't Clockwork Orange everybody. We can't strap them down to a chair and keep their eyeballs open and force them to watch Star Trek. But
we can't? Oh,
well,
damn it.
I think that would be frowned upon in our circles.
Exactly.
You know, exactly. So I think it's the challenge. One of the big challenges is that we used to have commonality. There used to be things we could come together and share. And that doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And it's such a loss, because the world Gene Roddenberry created, the world you are very much a part of and hopefully will continue to be, if you know what I'm saying, could really serve that purpose. I don't know that I have a question there, except just to point out that I feel your pain. And sometimes it's just kind of keeping your head down and just doing your work and putting out into the world.
Yes.
Right?
Mm. Yeah. I feel like that's all that that's what we can do. And that's what we all have to continue to try to do as much as possible, I think.
Yeah.
So going from the MAGA cult to something a lot more pleasant, how did you end up discovering a passion for cooking, Jerry?
I don't know. I've always loved it. I've just always, I've always enjoyed doing it, and I read cookbooks voraciously, and I've always loved it. I don't do as much of it now that I'm married to a Michelin-starred chef, because obviously he can do it.
That's I would imagine.
Oh my God, sometimes faster, yeah. He just does it, but I love it. I've always been a foodie. I love food. I love cooking. I love everything about it.
Did you have like a relative, like your? So I know so many people. It's like, oh well, my grandmother got me started somehow. Yeah.
I mean, my mom cooked. She was fine cook, and she cooked just to feed the family. It's not like she really enjoys it. She just cooked because we had to eat. I don't know where it came from, to be honest. I love food. I love cooking. I love everything about it.
So it wasn't just COVID.
No, it was not just COVID. This predates COVID by a long, long, long time.
What's your favorite cuisine?
I thought you did the sourdough bread from COVID. That did.
Yeah. Well, I think that was compulsory. Yeah. So what's your favorite cuisine to cook?
Well, I love baking.
Oh, okay.
But more, I'm more, most of my stuff that I do is more comfort food, like American comfort food kind of.
Okay.
Stuff. Oh.
And mostly because, you know, again, Michelin star chef. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to make French stuff. I'm not going to do, you know, there's no point doing the super fancy stuff that he knows and can outdo so easily with his eyes closed. So, yeah. So most of what I make is stuff that he wouldn't have grown up with or wouldn't really know.
Right.
So if you open your Julia Child, The Art of French Cooking, and you point to a recipe, he's like, oh, amateur hour.
Get a big workout. No. Doesn't get a big workout here.
Right. So there's no sense of competition between the two of you as far as that goes.
We actually have a good friend because very few people will invite us to dinner for all this.
Really?
One of our friends,
that's cheap.
Ironically, knows him from being a regular at his old restaurant. That's how they met.
Mm-hmm.
And she's one of the few that will still cook dinner and invite us over. But the first time we went to her house for dinner, and we get out of the car, and of course, you know, and she knows him. She knows this is not a surprise. We get out of the car, and he says, what are you making? And she said, boeuf bourguignon. I was like, you fool.
You're never going to impress this man.
It's a French classic, and then it is game on, and it, just, the critique just starts going. I said, it's Yankee beef stew. You are making Yankee beef stew. And then it would have been perfect, and there would be
little mac and cheese.
Oh my god!
That's so great.
That's hysterical.
Call it beef bourguignon, and then that was it.
It's like going. It's like trying to write a speech for Barack Obama. Here, Mr. Obama. Here's some words for you to say. See if you can bring some drama to this. Oh, give me a break! Come on. So, what's more stressful, working in a restaurant or owning a restaurant as you did, or working on Star Trek?
Oh God, restaurant world's way worse.
Totally,
way
I worse would imagine.
Can't even imagine.
God, yeah, horrible.
Don't you have to get up like five in the morning just like to get the food in, and it's crazy. It's like nonstop.
It's just nuts. It's very, very stressful, and it's exciting, but it's less of a pleasant industry, I think, to be in now. It's much more difficult. It was already pre-COVID. It was already hard enough to get staff and to deal with all of that.
Yeah.
It's even harder now for obvious reasons. I mean, why would you want to work in the service industry now after seeing everyone's worst selves? Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
And people are so much less behaved. Like, we had this great opportunity, I think, with when everyone went into lockdown and the world shifted, and we all had this. Well, I don't know if all of us did, but I certainly had this wonderful moment of thinking, oh my God, finally we can reset and people can understand that we can appreciate each other and support each other and be nicer. But that's not at all what happened. It was just a huge backlash in the other direction, and people got even nastier than they were before.
Yeah.
And anyway, so yeah.
Well, that's such a good point, and it's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about. Like, we did COVID, in a way, that at the very beginning, it felt like we had the same potential we had on September 12th,
we're gonna have this great
2001.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, yes.
September 12th, obviously, you know, I was in New York at the time, and it was, you know, as horrific a day as most of us have lived through. And yet, on September 12th, it felt like there was this extraordinary moment of global unity that if it had been utilized, if we had seized
it,
it would have changed the course of everything if the right person had been in charge. Same thing with COVID. I feel exactly the same way about COVID, and it revealed, as if we needed more information, but it revealed even more than I think we wanted to know. And the divisiveness, you know, continues to this day. But I think also the point about how people in the service industry were treated. It was something we needed to know, of course. But yeah, you're right. It's like there's sort of no going back from that unless there's we get yet another chance for a massive reset and don't blow it this time.
Yeah.
It's one of those events, I think, that could have led to a Star Trek future. If it had been seized upon in just the right way, in just the most positive way, where there's a global alliance and people coming together as a consequence of this. And that's what I'm constantly thinking about. Like, how do we get to the Star Trek future while jumping over some of those hurdles that the Star Trek canon has in our way, which is a eugenics war, a civil war, World War III, and we have to get through essentially three gigantic cataclysms before we get to Zefram Cochrane and the invention of warp drive and First Contact. So it's like I'm constantly thinking about stages in our development as a society. If Kennedy hadn't been assassinated, or if Vietnam had gone a different way, or if Nixon hadn't won in 68 and RFK had survived and he had become president, like what are these things in our history that would have brought us to the Star Trek future? And in fact, Ron Moore has started this amazing show for All Mankind that has that presents that alternative view of us. Have you ever considered that? Like, what do we got to do? What do we got to change right now to get to this place where my character exists and all of my friends' characters exist?
I mean, and there's so much that we have to change, but
yeah,
I don't know how to convince people to get there. Like,
yeah,
you know, fully half of our country is trying very hard to encourage acceptance and appreciation of differences and all of that. But there's a good half of our country that's fighting against that.
Yeah.
And until you stop being afraid of the other and stop considering anything that is different and beliefs that are different from yours as an enemy, we're not going to progress beyond where we are. And it's, and you know, this should have been the opportunity to start that. And it just didn't happen.
Yeah, and I think one of the getting back again to Seven in season three and her, I think, fascinating relationship with Captain Shaw is that he's right a lot of the time. Yeah. I mean, you cannot, you know, he may be an asshole from Chicago, yeah, but he's right. And yet then there's that one hang up of his, mm-hmm, that reminds me a lot of like how people are about certain things now, like, you know, difference, how different mm-hmm difference challenges them. Mm-hmm. I that has to have been intentional, of course. But as in the character's experience and your experience as an actor and Seven's experience, what was it like to experience both his deep disrespect on the one hand in this specific way, and yet his overcoming his own limitation to show the character enormous respect in another way? Because I thought it was one of the best things about the...
Absolutely. Mm. And what, yeah, one thing that I didn't really think about until I heard Todd talking about it in an interview is that the captain chooses their first officer.
Right.
The captain chooses their first officer.
Right.
So he knew this about himself, Shaw, I mean the character, and knew his strong bias against the Borg, and still chose a former Borg as his first officer. And especially when you see at the end, in the last episode, when he Seven watches his officer review of her, which was done before the events of season three.
Mm-hmm.
Then you learn that he did appreciate her. He was a jerk and he wasn't very respectful and he, you know, wasn't very pleasant, but he did always understand her value. And so that already, I think, says a lot about him. That's a lot better off than where a lot of us are now, in that we don't want to challenge ourselves in any way. You just want everything to be the way you want it to be. And he's just such a fantastic character. He was so complex. Mm. And
so good.
And Todd played it so, so perfectly.
Yeah, it was completely brilliant. And that's the thing. Like, we're not asking people to say, you need to think like we do about everything.
Right.
You know, we all have things that we wish we were better at or you know, we were just better people, right? And that's the thing about Shaw. He knew what his limitation was.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was still prejudiced.
Yeah.
And disrespectful in that way. But he knew it was his problem.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't going to do anything necessarily to.
No, he wasn't necessarily working on it to fix it, but nope. But yes.
But he wasn't going to interfere.
Yeah.
With doing the right thing, and yeah. It would be nice. Like I just thought that was one thing that just totally encapsulated what we need more of. That shouldn't be that hard.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you got, if people could just accept that, you know, their prejudices, they have limitations. And if you have a problem with somebody's difference from you, you're the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It should be so simple, right?
Yeah. It should be, shouldn't it?
It should be.
Yeah. We lost Mary. Where'd Mary go?
You didn't lose, hang on.
What? Is she getting a present for us, Jerry? Is that what she's doing? I'm not sure.
I just want to stop getting bitten.
Oh, so. There you go. Hey, look at Sebastian.
Want to say hi? Say hi to Jerry. Bob.
What a beauty.
You just wanted to stand up. Okay.
He was on your shoulder during one of your other shows, Mary, and I couldn't pay attention to anything that was being said because I was just watching him walking around doing stuff.
Utterly checking distracting.
Out. Yeah, what was yeah. I was doing an interview with the Midas Touch guys for their podcast, and I don't know where Sebastian was, but in the middle of the interview he flies onto my head and
he just has free reign. He just goes right
yeah away. Oh yeah, totally. It makes my life fancy. But
I was gonna say I
can't put him birds should not be pets in my view. I saved him from a pet store, but I can't. The idea of putting him in a cage all day long is and you know he deals with the cats. He keeps them in line. So anyway, he flies on my head and one of the guys says, "Is that your bird?" And I said, "No."
That's the best answer. Oh my God. Okay, Jerry, thank you so much for being here today. You're the best. How do people follow you on social media? How do people get all the latest points of view and information about what's up with your life?
I am at Jerry L. Ryan. On I think everything actually. It's that's Instagram, perfect. That's Twitter, that's Blue Sky, that's Mastodon.
Oh wow.
It's all the things. It's
all the things.
Audible, yeah. There's a bunch of them now.
Exactly.
To be honest, but we'll see.
Hopefully there will be some news in the not too distant future that we can discuss.
We'll see.
Yes. Hashtag Star Trek Legacy. We got to get that out there. Seriously, exactly. Sign the petition, circulate the hashtag. We got to get this done.
I can't tell you how much it meant to us to have you on the show. And I've been a huge admirer of your work, Star Trek and non-Star Trek, for a long time. So this is like the coolest thing ever. So thank you.
Thank you. You guys are awesome. Thanks so much.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right. That was extraordinary.
Yes.
Jesus. I think we're just going to have to make this podcast 6 hours long.
Because you know what? I had about 1,000 more questions about food for her.
Right.
And it's not just because we're recording this at the lunch hour and I'm starving.
Yeah. And I just love her perspective on what's happening now and how her, not just her character, but Star Trek overall have both evolved. It was just a totally fascinating conversation. And again, hopefully there will be news in the not too distant future. And either way, I mean, there's so much more to talk about. So I don't know. I thought that was just a pretty decent way to keep this string going. I cannot believe that, having watched Star Trek now for over 50 years, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
But in a good way, that we're getting to talk to the people who are directly responsible for, you know, keeping the dream alive. So that I'm really grateful.
Yeah, and next week we've got Todd Stashwick, Captain Shaw. And I remember seeing Todd Stashwick for the first time in The Riches. I don't know if you ever watched that show. It was Eddie Izzard and Minnie Driver, and they played these Irish travelers, who's kind of con artists, and they con their way into this McMansion. And Stashwick plays the villain of the show. And he was so compelling. Every time he would come on screen, my interest in the show was already, you know, at peak levels, but then it would go to 11 as soon as Todd would come on. And hi, Sebastian. I love that Sebastian is part of the show, too.
Yeah, he's just trampling all over my keyboard. God knows awesome. What documents I'm losing as we speak. But I don't know. It's worth it. It makes him happy to join us. And just as a quick aside, I recently rewatched, I don't even know why. Oh, Buffy the Vampire Slayer was trending on Twitter, yeah, as it does occasionally. I never really quite know why, but because it's not on anymore, for those of you keeping track.
Right, right.
But the episode The Body was mentioned, and it is one of the great episodes. It's a shame that the person responsible for creating such a great show is such an awful person. But it is still a great show. So I rewatched The Body, and I decided it's sort of in the middle of season 6. And I decided to keep watching because I love it. And I haven't seen it in a really long time. And I also, it's sort of as a palate cleanser in between Star Trek episodes.
Oh, and, yeah, yeah.
guess who was a guest star?
Todd Stashwick.
Todd
awesome.
Stashwick. He plays, I don't remember the episode because that's your job, not mine. He plays a demon called Mafashnik.
Wow.
And Dawn, Buffy's sister, says to Giles, he says, is it pronounced like cookie? And he just says, no, it's just Mafashnik. So, anyway, he's totally unrecognizable, but you could hear his voice, and it was just oh my God, that's so cool.
We got to get his perspective on that D&D round with Jerry. That would
Oh my gosh.
To get both sides of it, yeah.
Yeah, and I'd love to hear what he thinks about the new D&D movie as a somebody who is into Dungeons. I'm not, so I wasn't looking for any flaws because I wouldn't know what they were. So kind of curious about that. But mostly his take on Picard season 3 and the fascinating Captain Liam Shaw.
Yes.
And, you know, what the future may or may not hold. So, Bob, it's great to have this one in the books.
Yes.
Thank you, my friend.
And oh, by the way, thank you to everyone who made us number one in Apple Podcast Science Fiction. Yeah, got to mention that.
Yeah, let's keep it
Perfect
going.
Time to do that. Yes, thank you so much.
All right, thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.